This is Audible.
Chapter 27, September 2057. I just never imagined I'd be doing this myself, Tash said to Grace Butterworth, or rather yelled to her, over the noise of the RAF helicopter that airlifted them out of Gateshead into a murky volcano ash sky, headed north towards Thornus. Grace, ex-military herself, looked at home strapped into the confines of a bucket seat. Tash thought she never would have guessed that there was a cute photo of Grace's nine-month-old niece, Billy, tucked under her bulletproof vest. But even as she spoke, Tash noticed Grace never took her eyes off Fred Bowles, or rather the back of his head a couple of rows of seats ahead of them, as he earnestly went through material on phones and tablets with a couple of his advisors. Grace said now, "Doing what? You mean a ride in a chopper? The plane would be quicker, but choppers fly lower, under the volcanic ash. No, not that. Well, yes, me. In an RAF chopper. But mostly, me going to the moon." "Oh, right," Grace grinned, and ran a hand over her crew-cut hair. "I know. Well, I did this bit once before. The ride into space, at least. Training on military hardware in low orbit. Fred has never flown either. He has to go. England has to establish a presence at Sinus Medii, in that monument park that's grown up there." The park had grown out of the gathering, in the last few months, of streams of international visitors to the lurker on the moon, many of whom had left behind tokens and messages. Similarly, nations, corporations, churches, colleges, and other groups had sent small probes to the area, carrying inscriptions or tokens. It had grown into Earth's more or less spontaneous cultural response to the startling presence of an alien artifact on the moon, and, apparently, to one you could see, even could have touched without the security barriers, as opposed to the immense invisibility of Galaxias itself. Soon, inevitably, the park had been formalized, and under FIS governance was hosted fairly graciously by the Chinese, who had a more significant presence on the moon than any other nation. But security had got tighter after a number of attempts to challenge the spawn of Galaxias, as some called it, with displays of obscenity, defiance, threat. And now it was the turn of the Federal States of England to make a formal contribution to the park. As Tash had understood it, the English monument itself was already up on the moon. Now she was flying up there with a party for the formal unveiling. Grace went on. "The PM had to send a cabinet minister with our contribution, and it had to be Fred, didn't it?" Mel, sitting behind them with Charlie Marlowe, herself buried in work, leaned forward and yelled over the noise of the chopper. "Logical, yes. He's the science minister. It's his domain." "No," Grace said. "It's not that. He's senior enough to be a weighty presence, junior enough to be disposable." Tash suppressed a grin. "Don't let him hear you say that. Oh, I think he knows." There was some talk of sending a royal, but the king himself vetoed that. "Also, Fred's going because we're still bidding for November. The big FIS conference, the heads of state. England's got to host that. We can't afford to build the big stuff like this Chinese factory effort on the moon, or even Xi's firecracker spaceship. But we do know how to put on a diplomatic show." Mel nodded. "I did hear they're thinking of hosting it in New Aberdeen this time. Although I suppose that might mean sharing some credit with the Scottish and the Dutch." Mel and Grace started to debate that. Tash turned back to her phone, the latest messages, the talking heads whose voices whispered through the buds in her ears about current government issues. She couldn't concentrate on any of it. She looked out of her window and down on post-blink Scotland. Glassy sheets of water that were relics of floods from the Hypercane storm in April. Sprawling structures of pale plastic set up to protect emergency food crops from the unseasonably cold weather. All chaotically assembled amid still young carbon capture forests. Relics of the last global crisis. She was going to the moon. Holy shit. And one other, at least, of the in-jokes would be with her. The second time for Mel in a few months. Maybe she would be watching. Although, she thought sadly, probably not. It seemed no time at all before the pilot quietly spoke in their ears to announce the beginning of the descent into Thorness, on the west coast of Scotland. And Tash, peering out of her window again, saw an airfield with kilometres-long runways, stripes on the ground. No, this was not an airfield, or not anymore. A spaceport. The passengers were hustled off the chopper, across a few metres of tarmac, and into a surprisingly primitive terminal building. Here, detached from their luggage and carry-ons, they were sorted into rough seniority groups and bundled through a boarding process that Tash quickly found intrusive, even by the standards of such procedures. In a small cubicle, she had to strip naked and pass through a shower and body scanner before being allowed to dress in her own clothes once more. Meanwhile, the clothes themselves had been irradiated. They had all been warned about a dress code. The recommended costumes were coveralls and soft slip-on shoes. Only a couple of the group had bent the rules too far, had their own clothes confiscated, and emerged in compulsorily imposed and ill-fitting RAF blue flight suits. Tash actually felt a faint twinge of envy over the cool-looking suits. Very adolescent of her, she thought. After this, she was reunited with her colleagues in a small, sparse lounge. Here they collected secure clones of their phones and other gadgets. Fred Bowles was back at work already, going through red box briefings on a tablet. And Charlie Marlowe too sat alone, speaking quietly into the air whilst paging through her phone. Tash sat with Mel and Grace at a small table. Only clear water to drink, she saw. "So, this is space travel," she said. That check-in process was somewhat thorough. Grace, her own phone in her hand, just shrugged. "You're going into space on a military-class machine. What did you expect? And this is an RAF base, or was. Built during the Second World War. Let out as a science and technology park for a few decades, then taken back as a spaceport," she grinned. "The potholes filled in, the runways lengthened a bit." This was a while after the RAF was given responsibility for supervising Britain's access to space. Mel asked, "Why not the RASF? She emphasised the S. "I always wondered, if it's now an air and space force." Grace just gave her a look. "I was in the Marines. I haven't a lot of time for these flyboys and their toys. But change RAF? Are you mad? Or just a traitor?" Tash smiled. An orderly came by, subtly beckoning. Grace stood up. "Time to board." The interior of the Skylon 4B was less roomy than Tash had expected, but maybe more like an airliner than she had thought, with rows of conventional-looking seats in pairs set in a passenger compartment that represented, she surmised, only a small percentage of the volume of the long, sleek hull she had glimpsed from the transfer bus. But then, as Mel had told her as they boarded, most of that volume was taken up by fuel. "And that's hydrogen," she murmured. "The lightest element. Needs a lot of tankage." So Tash sat with Grace beside her, Mel and Charlie just behind her, Bowles and his team ahead. Tash's seat was smart and seemed to mould itself to her body as she sat down, with a rest riding up and gripping her neck and head, not uncomfortably, and a kind of heavy-duty belt swathing her belly. Grace was already busy on her phone, supervising something or other. Before her own seat swallowed her up, Mel reached forward and gripped Tash's shoulder. "Enjoy the ride, kiddo." "Hope so," Tash said. "And whether or not I keep my lunch down, I want to tell Dad all about it. You know, I think he's proud of me and where I've got to. But he's not particularly interested in the mechanics of government. A space plane ride, though." "I know. They won't let us record stuff, of course. Last time I tried to remember it all for Jane, the first time, my daughter," she said for Grace's benefit. Grace nodded. "I remember. How old? 12? "In December." She'd be the perfect age for this, probably. And then, with a curt announcement over a PA, the Skylon began to roll forward. The windows were tiny and awkwardly placed. There was a virtual display array hanging in the air before Tash's face, but it was hard to follow the details. Naturally, Tash hadn't followed Grace's advice to look it all up in advance, but still, the experience soon became extraordinary. With the plane already rolling, somewhere in back, huge engines lit up, working in jet mode, as she understood it. For now, burning hydrogen from those big tanks in oxygen drawn from the atmosphere. A roar gathered for maybe 5 seconds, and then the craft leapt forward, thrusting her deep in her chair. Grace didn't turn her head, but when she spoke, her voice carried. Runway's 5 miles long, and they do still brag about it in miles. God bless the RAF. The plane tipped up without warning and flung itself into the sky. Tash could feel it, feel how she was lying on her back. Visualize the dark blue needle climbing through the air, murky and turbulent as it was. And now she felt the thrust build up, pushing her back into her seat. She had been told it would be no worse than 3 gravities, no more strenuous than a Scare the Punters amusement park ride, but it felt a lot more than that. Felt as if some huge open hand was pushing down on her ribs, her belly. Then, only perhaps 10 seconds into the flight, a shudder, a rattle, almost as if they had struck some physical barrier. And a sudden smoothing out, a reduction of the ambient noise. "Through the sound barrier already," Grace yelled, unnecessarily loudly now. Tash dared not turn her head to look out of the window, but the seatback display in front of her showed how the ground just fell away. The runway stripes soon lost in the wider countryside, the sky around her deepening to a rich blue. "Here's the trick," Mel called behind Tash. "To get to orbit in a single-stage ship, you need an engine that works in different modes. So we fly like a jet plane until we get to Mach 5, maybe 40 kilometers up, and then we switch over to using liquid oxygen from our internal tanks to burn what's left of the hydrogen, rocket mode. That's about a minute into the flight, which is now." A sharp transition. The thrust in Tasha's back felt tougher, sharp-edged. But then, here was a different mode of engine pushing a much lighter vehicle, now mostly devoid of its fuel. Of course, it would feel tough, rattly. It seemed to go on and on. And the cutoff, when it came, was another brutal transition. Not so much a loss of thrust as a feeling of being hurled forward against her straps. Then a fall back into her seat, a crash, not a cutout. It was over then. Tash sat back, breathing hard. Through her tiny window, she saw black sky, a curve of bright blue earth. Like a strip of a photograph of a tropical sky. She felt her stomach churn as she moved her head. Weightlessness. "And now you're in orbit," Grace said, but her voice was choked. Tash turned in surprise. She saw tears rolling down Grace's cheeks. Impulsively, Tash reached for Grace's hand. She felt scar tissue under her own palm. "Hey, what's wrong?" "Oh, it's just... sorry, don't tell the flyboys I blubbed. They're big-headed enough already. It's just that it's all so magnificent, you know? We did this. We dumb humans. We built planes that can fly into space. Even the British. Even if... and now this bastard Galaxius comes along and... what? Tells us to stay in the playpen?" She shook her head, dug out a tissue, blew her nose. "Even if there's no Britain anymore," Tash completed the line. When she sat back and looked around at her companions, she saw Charlie Marlowe folding out her gadgets, her phones and a tablet, as if this was just another office to work in. And soon Grace was taking an efficient-looking nap. Tash tried to let go of her hand, but Grace, in her sleep, hung on. In the hours that followed, Tash and the rest of Fred Bowles' party transferred to a Jones Inc. Earth Moon, a clumsy, irregularly shaped habitat that did nothing but cycle endlessly between Earth and Moon. Then the three-day journey itself, coasting to the Moon and watching the whole Earth recede. Mel got nauseous, space sick, which turned the habitat into a hospital ward you couldn't leave. There was always one, said the crew, and being a one-time veteran like Mel was no guarantee of immunity. Even Charlie was sympathetic, not Grace, however. Then a transfer to the Lunar Gateway, another habitat, this one in permanent lunar orbit. 6 hours later, a final descent to the lunar surface in a moonlander, a big, spherical, spindly-legged Jones Inc. creation. On the surface, a transfer to another Jones element, a moonhab, for a couple of days of orientation, suit fitting and training, clumsy fun. Then a 50-kilometer ride in a big lunar rover, a moon bus, yet another Jones design. Jones really did have this technology sewn up, Tash reflected. An hour of slow-motion jostling in their suits. And then, Tasha's own first footsteps on the moon. She hadn't been allowed out of any of the various vehicles before this moment. Climbing off the rover, like everybody else, Tash made her own Armstrong footprint, a traveller's ritual, like crossing the equator. Her own one small step in the lunar dust, the boot cleats clearly visible in the crisp ground, the low sunlight. A hasty photograph, then she moved on. Thrilling, astonishing, all of it. Just as Mel had described to her after her own jaunt earlier in the year. And she was here. She had come to the Sinus Medii and the Lurker. She looked around slowly, carefully, keen to remember it all. Here on the airless moon, under a black sky in which Earth and Sun hung like lanterns. In this place where Earth had once rested at the apex of the sky. Why, she didn't even feel afraid of the big black sky. This wasn't the sky that had betrayed her in Newcastle, she supposed. Look at me, Dad. But, once away from the rover, the landscape's outstanding feature turned out to be a wall, a big circular barrier of what looked like melted rock, maybe 5 meters tall, like some fortress. And outside the wall, a line of figures in deep blue pressure suits. Blue, the signature of the Chinese on the moon. And that was where the Lurker was, she knew, behind that wall. She soon learned that they could only pass through one of the few gateways in this wall, evidently heavily guarded. And to get there, the English party had to walk a half kilometre from where the moon bus had dropped them. So they all moonwalked. Fred Bowles, the science minister, Charlie Marlowe, the astronomer royal, their entourage. They were trailed by a few English and other British nationals who had shared the moon bus with them. These were longer stay residents, mostly scientists or habitat support staff, here for 6 month assignments, roped into today's chore, and probably glad of a change of routine, Tash soon realised. A handful of Chinese guards shadowed them at a distance, almost politely. This security was all routine, Grace told her gruffly. No lander was allowed to approach closer than 50 kilometres to the Lurker site. And no human-carrying vehicle at all was allowed any closer than half a kilometre from this outer perimeter, this wall. Not even the zippy rovers used by the fizz-controlled security forces. One such vehicle had carried the only significant cargo the English party had brought to the moon. The box that contained their nation's contribution to the fast-growing monument park. Now a team of local volunteers were lugging by hand, these last few metres, a coffin-shaped package that had been brought all the way from Gateshead. But the hike wasn't a chore. Walking on the moon was deceptively simple, Tash found, rather to her delight. You really did just bunny hop your way around. It was easy, almost instinctive, even in the heavy vacuum-proof, radiation-proof suits they all had to wear. And the suits were smart. Every so often, one of the novices did make a misstep, and the suit would right itself, thanks to a built-in exoskeleton. Tasha's helmet was so big, her field of vision through the visor so wide. the sun's glare so expertly filtered that sometimes it was as if she wasn't wearing a helmet at all. It certainly didn't get in the way of her view of the ground under that high black sky. A ground that itself seemed more interesting close to than she had expected. It was a heavy dust, pittered with craters that could be the scale of a football on a dry, sandy beach on Earth. Or much smaller, or much larger. Many too wide for her to make out properly from a human eye-level perspective, she was sure. Craters within craters and overlapping. Here and there the sunlight glistened off some reflective grain, embedded in this dust that itself was the product of billions of years of impacts. A world of debris. And yet, when she turned her head, the angle of the sunlight changed, and she perceived different colours, from a washed-out grey to a kind of tan. Thus, the moon, exotic, churned-up dust, and a handful of people stumbling across its surface. And that wall around an alien artifact. A wall that did indeed, she judged now as she approached, look like it really had been made by melting rock. Lunar basalt, she supposed. At the wall itself, at the gates, more security, armed guards, and drones of various kinds patrolling a heavily surveilled sky. Tash understood the security was necessary, and not that difficult to implement. The tentative colonization of the moon had been a political success, well, compared to most human politics. The Artemis Accord, agreed by spacefaring nations, based on old space law principles and drawn up before a new wave of landings in the 2030s, had held together pretty well. On the whole, it seemed, people up here cooperated. The moon itself was more alien than any terrestrial differences, and was a lethal place besides. But the lurker had provoked different reactions. There had been too many threats against it, from various groups on a ravaged Earth, for any chances to be taken. It did the authorities no good to stress the theory that the lurker was just a probe, not a part of Galaxias itself, that striking at it would be useless. This was all there was to strike at, hence the wall. At last, gates were thrown open. There were final security checks as they passed through the Moon Rock Fortress wall itself. Tash had long since lost count of how many times the party and its cargo had been checked over to get here. Starting with the transport from Government House itself up to Thornus. Then finally, once through the gates, they spread out, apparently unconsciously, Tash thought, and looked around. None too subtle guards, some Chinese, some with Fizz peacekeeper emblems, dispersed among them, watching carefully. And within the wall, Tash saw an enclosed patch of lunar terrain, littered with stuff. Flags, photographs, models, statues, even a few flickering hologram images, tributes to the alien. The single most obvious human landmark visible within the wall's curtain was what looked like a squat boiler, a cylinder meters high, panelled with what might be aluminium, surrounded with a kind of ribbing for structural strength or heat management, maybe. Fred Bowles, breathing hard with the effort, murmured over their shared radio link. "What the hell is that?" "I'm not sure," Charlie Marlowe replied, "but I believe it's Chinese. Their tribute to the park. I'll try to find out." Bowles just snorted. "Well, that's just typical." He glanced around at his entourage. "Makes our contribution look like a Christmas cracker toy. But quality rather than quantity, eh? Let's hope Galaxias has good taste." "Or a sense of humour," Grace murmured. "I heard that," Bowles snapped. "Come on, let's get on with it." They walked deeper in, past the human clutter. And right at the heart of the walled compound was a mound of dirt. That was what it looked like, nothing more. A shallow heaping surrounded by a bank of cameras and other scientific gear. And a ring of human soldiers, each heavily armed in some kind of battle suit. Most, but not all, Chinese and Fizz. A drone camera drifted overhead, tiny squirts of propellant exhaust balancing the low lunar gravity. Tash had seen many images of this. She shivered. That was it. The lurker inside its mound. Or maybe the mound itself was part of it. An alien technology, just paces away from where she was standing. And assuming it was technology, it was so subtle, so simple. It made the human devices look like children's toys. Always interested in human reactions, Tash glanced at her companions. Fred Bowles stared in open wonder. Mel seemed more conflicted. She had been here before, Tash remembered. Now she seemed more distracted or dismayed by the gathering collection of human clutter. But Grace looked more calculating, as if weighing up an enemy. The Astronomer Royal took charge for now. "Shall we start, Fred?" "Very well. Cameras set up." There was no single camera operator. They all wore microdot cameras on chest and helmet, and now a couple more drones hovered overhead. Tash knew that all these feeds would be combined into a three-dimensional diorama to be sent back to Earth, both for the news channels and for history. "So," Bowles began, "for the record, here we are, in Monument Park, Sinus Medii, Luna. We are grateful for the hospitality of China, the other nations, and the Fizz, who are cooperating to make this remarkable location a safe and secure place, and who have made us welcome today. I will leave it to the Astronomer Royal to explain the significance of this place and what we are about to see." Charlie stepped forward. "Thank you, Minister." She kept her enunciation clear and deliberate, Tash noted with some admiration. "So, Sinus Medii, media savvy, the Middle Bay. Once this spot would have been dead centre of the visible face of the moon, as seen from Earth. The middle, as in the name. But now, as we know, since the blink, the moon has been turning slowly on its axis away from its old orientation. So that at times this spot looks away from the Earth entirely, taking what's buried here with it." She led the way towards that mound of dirt at the centre of the wall's enclosure. She had to weave a path through a rough inner ring of previously placed monuments, mostly flags, a few statues of leaders or gods. Some more enigmatic offerings, a lump of rock from Iceland, Tash noticed. A basaltic gift to this planet of basalt. All of this was dominated by the huge Chinese structure, though. Marlowe continued. "Strange to think that before Blink Day, there was pretty much nothing here," she pointed. "Nothing but that central mound and what it contained, and only two human artifacts. The now infamous Surveyor 6, a spindly frame in its own small-walled compound, and the later US spy probe, unnamed, now removed." The Surveyor was individually guarded, Tash saw. Mel murmured in a closed loop that such precautions hadn't been necessary when she was here back in May. But Tash knew that given the revelation of a decades-long cover-up of the evidence it had supplied of an alien artifact on the moon, the American probe had itself become a secondary target of terrorism. Especially by conspiracy theorists who thought there was no Galaxius. And all this was got up by an American-Chinese cabal. "And now, all this," Marlowe said. "Monuments, gifts, if you like. Ambiguous symbols, perhaps. But a human response that has gathered momentum ever since we determined there is indeed an alien artifact buried in that central mound. The so-called Lurker. A probe we associate with the phenomenon of Galaxius, by Occam's razor." "Keep it basic, Charlie," murmured Bowles. Marlowe sighed. "Very well. Edit. We have evidence of two incursions of alien intelligence in the solar system. The blink itself, of course, and now this artifact on the moon. It's simplest to assume that the two things are connected. We do have some direct evidence of that connection in the lump of water ice that the Lurker apparently fired off on Blink Day. And we have to believe, do we not, that this engine is watching us now, as it may have watched us for thousands of years. Or more. Perhaps for hundreds of millions of years. The moon is stable enough for that." She tipped back. Tash could see she was looking up at the black sky. Marlowe went on. And through its eyes, Galaxius watches us, perhaps. Which is why we, I suppose, at a national and individual level, have come here, an attempt to show Galaxius who we are. All this reminds me of the Pioneer plaque, Mel murmured Tash via a closed circuit. Fixed to Pioneer 10, remember? Which was the first to break out of the solar system and apparently the trigger for Galaxius to take an interest in us. That was an attempt to communicate, images of people, science data, just in case somebody out there ever found it. Here we go again. This is the Pioneer plaque spread out on the surface of the moon, before the eye of the alien. As I look around, I see flags, images, technological achievements, statues mostly of people, not all. There is an exquisite tree carved from coral over there. And apart from the national gestures, there are contributions from other sorts of groups, religions, artists, musicians, some sent by families, some by individuals. People even want to set up live feeds on screens, just to show the lurker how we live. Well, why not? Certainly this has turned into a display of the diversity and richness of our culture. And now, it is the proud turn of the English Federation to make our own contribution. And cut. Fred Bowles grunted. Well done, Charlie. This is all rather touching, now I see it. But, off the record, all this junk, wistful, don't you think? When I stand here and look at it all, like a child trying to get its parents' attention. And then there's that bloody great oil tank from the Chinese. Off the record still. Does anybody have the slightest clue what that is? Charlie? Marlowe hesitated. Well, it's no oil tank. To me, and this is off the record too. And just on the evidence of what I see here, and some feedback from colleagues I've been asking, I think they might be building something like a tokamak.
The what now?
The core of a fusion reactor, or at least one of the old experimental designs. To get nuclear fusion, you need to squeeze hydrogen to extremes of pressure and temperature. And the way you do that, if you aren't at the heart of the sun where you have gravity to help, is with magnetic fields, very intense. And you get those by running powerful electrical currents through, well, through an architecture like that. Tash said, actually, I'm surprised they were allowed to bring something so big inside this cordon. Given the room it takes up and the security implications. Bowles said, oh, I imagine there were protests. But the Chinese, on the whole, get what the Chinese want, on the moon anyhow. I mean, how could we stop them? But why would the Chinese want to build something like that here? Is it safe? Could it be construed as a weapon by Galaxius? Even if that's not the conscious intent. Marlowe said, I think that's moot. I'm sure this is only a demonstration setup. The question is why the Chinese want to show this to the lurker and Galaxius. What message are they trying to send? That's the question. Mel sounded puzzled too. Maybe there's more to come. I mean, we know that elsewhere on the moon, and on analogy sites in Earth, the Chinese are experimenting with automation, industry, replication as we know. Maybe this is just another component of that, a part of some eventual, complete installation, which nobody has guessed at yet, and which nobody outside Beijing knows about. Bowles said with a sigh. Well, let's hope that whatever they eventually unveil will do more good than harm. Although for sheer bulk it puts our feeble effort to shame, doesn't it? Oh, come on, Fred, cheer up, Marlowe said. We're English, remember? It's class, not mass, that counts. Quite right, of course, Astronomer Royal. Well said. So let's get this done before this suit starts to itch. I know our allotted site is just over there. He pointed to a patch of bare ground, delineated by small tokens, symbols of the Federal English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh, others. I'll lead, sir, Grace said, stepping forward, if I may. Bowles appeared to shrug, a gesture largely masked by his suit. Grace went back to the external gate and briskly organised the handful of pressure-suited locals who had lugged the monument in its container here from the Rovers. Now they picked up the package again, hauled it across the much-trampled lunar ground through the gate and into the walled compound, and carefully set it down, standing erect. These worker bees, marching clumsily by, probably all had PhDs, Tash thought. Then Grace herself opened the box by punching a keycode into a panel. Automated, the box opened and folded itself out of the way. Tash looked on curiously, with security being as tight as it was. As far as she knew, only Grace had the setup codes for this thing. And Tash herself didn't know what the British gift to the Monument Park was going to be. She hadn't even seen the shortlist. What was brought out of the casing was a pillar, itself perhaps a metre and a half tall, mounted on a stiff metal rod perhaps twice as long. The pillar, with transparent panels, contained something she couldn't quite see. Books, perhaps. The setup was obvious. More gophers brought tools from the moon bus. A standing frame, a drill. Bowles himself was asked to make the final selection of a suitable spot. Then the gophers set up their frame, positioned the heavy-duty drill, and let it create a fine hole in the regolith, some metres deep, judging by the drill head's smooth descent. The task looked easy, but took several minutes. Tash did know this rig was adapted from essentially scientific gear, meant for extracting moon rock samples from deep underground. Or for probing the heat flow from the moon's interior. Expensive, finely tooled stuff. Hauled here at huge expense, borrowed for the day, made fit for the purpose of erecting a monument before an alien artifact. Grace wandered over. For the record, for you science types, they're telling me this site is typical of the moon. When it comes to sticking stuff into it, I mean. The surface is dust, smashed up by minor impacts. And a few metres down you get huge boulders created by more major impacts. It's all gaps and hard lumps. And you need a bit of skill to drill deep and securely. But there we are. They've got it done. Now then. She went back over and led the next manoeuvre personally. The team lifted the monument from its final casing and removed a soft inner wrap. Then they cradled pillar and stand and lifted it high until the stand was over the drilled hole, into which it slid smoothly. Could have been tricky, Mel said to Tash. An awkward object like that in the lunar gravity. Thick gloves, inflexible suits. But those graduate student types are obviously used to it all. Don't really need Grace fussing around, I wouldn't think. Oh, Grace is pretty essential, Tash said. Because Grace is the only one of us with the whole series of set-up security codes in her head. The monument will be powered. It has to be, to protect its contents from the lunar conditions. And so has to have location codes and identity beacons and such built in. Security protocols, required by the FIS committee that is doing its best to oversee this place. So when the speeches are done, Grace will enter a final code to switch it all on, to identify it as harmless to the local security system. And then we can leave the contents in safety. What contents? Mel asked. Well, even I don't know. Tash said. One last layer of security. She glanced over at Bowles, who was already standing by the monument, ready to make the short dedication speech that he had come all this way to deliver. Another aide called for them both to lift their sun visors for the duration of the announcement, so their faces could be seen by the audiences on Earth. Bowles had last-minute second thoughts about that, and ordered all those in shot, including Grace, to lift their visors too and look at the cameras. There should be no hidden faces in the final image. When they were ready, Bowles nodded to Grace. She tapped a hidden control in the pillar, whose surface now turned entirely transparent, to reveal what was evidently a very ancient book, open on a wooden stand. My name is Fred Bowles, Science Minister of the Federal States of England, and today representing all the nations and peoples of the British Isles and Dependencies, I, with Astronomer Royal Professor Charlotte Marlowe and our team, are here on the surface of the moon at the Sinus Medii, the so-called Monument Park, where we are unveiling the British contribution to this remarkable, almost spontaneous, effort. A gesture of welcome, of celebration. Tash knew what would be going through his mind now. It was absolutely crucial for England to get hold of the hosting of the November FIS conference. And this was one of the government's best chances to pitch for that prize. So it was absolutely clear, she thought a little cynically, that Bolzer's primary audience was human, not extraterrestrial. And now the gift, the big reveal. What we contribute here is a selection from the journals of Captain James Cook. That is, the original manuscripts from the British Library collection. You can see that we have arranged for these ancient documents to be protected from the sun's unfiltered light by this pillar. It will become transparent at a touch, opaque by default. Artificial light will illuminate the whole installation in the lunar night. Cook was a British explorer of the 18th century. He greatly enhanced the science of exploration itself, navigation, sustenance, the health of his crews, and the knowledge of the world for the benefit of his own nation and ultimately for the benefit of humanity in general. But there was a dark side to his story. As a representative of an imperial power, Cook claimed territories such as Australia for Britain, regardless of the wishes of the peoples already living there. Local people were injured or killed, their artifacts plundered. It was part of Cook's job. He did it effectively and efficiently. Why then do we choose to celebrate such an ambiguous figure here and now? Because we, the modern British governments and successors to the regime that sent Cook out, feel that we humans should show the whole truth about ourselves to Galaxias. We are imperfect creatures. All our past is ambiguous. But we are learning. We can celebrate Cook's explorations while expressing dismay over and apologizing for their adverse impact. We are scientists. We are technologists. We are explorers. We are immature, even in our dealings with each other. But we are capable of improvement. That is what we want Galaxias to understand. With one gloved hand, Bowles touched the pillar in which the Cook papers rested in their casket. A casket that now filled with light, revealing ancient, curled pages. Tash shivered. Some instinct made her glance over at the lurker mound. Are you watching, Galaxias? Even now? And she saw Grace Butterworth grinned widely, as if she had achieved some personal goal.